Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton, this is my show, the Scott Horton Show. I just realized how bad at math I am. Got all this stuff to talk about on the show today, and well, one of the half hours I dedicated to it. No, they gotta go to play an interview from the other day. The other day, Saturday, I interviewed Dan McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity at ronpaulinstitute.org, all about the situation in Ukraine. And the thing of it is that after I was done interviewing him, about, I don't know, 20 minutes later, something like that, I got an email saying, oh yeah, by the way, no show for you on KPFK this week because you've been preempted by the fund drive. Which is okay, because hey, they have to have a fund drive or I can't have a show on there at all. So that's fine with me. And it's even fine that they forgot to tell me. What do I care? The problem being, though, that I had this Daniel McAdams interview all dressed up and nowhere to play it. So anyway, well, of course it's online. Some of you may have already heard it. But I'm going to play it for you on the show today. The only thing I was complaining about, I'm happy to play for you. It's a great interview. The only thing I was complaining about was that, I forgot about it. I spaced out about it until just now. So I was going to talk about Palestine and this, that, and the other thing. Oh, well, that's all right. I got Chase Madar on about that. I'm wasting time right now. How about this? Chase Madar is going to be on the show today to talk about American support for Israel, what they're doing wrong, not what they're doing right. And so that's coming on. And then also, Ryan Devereaux, I don't know who he is either, but he's the new guy at First Look Media, which is the new project of Pierre Omidyar, the zillionaire, and the subsidiary, online magazine they're calling it or something, The Intercept, has just gone online today with their very first piece. It's the NSA's secret role in the U.S. assassination program, and we kind of had a little bit of heads up that this was coming for a while here. I guess back when the whole project first leaked, they talked about, yeah, Jeremy Scahill here is going to be combining his work on the drone program and the JSOC and CIA assassination programs with the Snowden documents and Greenwald's work on the NSA, and that's coming up. So, just as promised, this was their first piece. It's at firstlook.org/The Intercept. firstlook.org/The Intercept. And I will note that I had some weird problems and 503 errors. I don't know which one is a 503. Hey, chat room guys, you're geniuses. Which error is a 503? Does that mean they're blaming me? Because I don't ever see the errors that I got on The Intercept. I don't see those anywhere else, the weird things. So, I don't know. I accuse the NSA and the GCHQ of attempting to DDoS attack The Intercept because I think that they're petty jerks like that. How about that? How about they are guilty beyond a shadow of a doubt until proven innocent beyond a shadow of a doubt? Since that's the way they like to play it. Anyway, I'm sure Pierre Omidyar can afford top-notch computer security there for his new project. Let's hope so. Hey, the address is HTTPS in the first place. To look at any of their pages, it's one of those so-called secure connections anyway. So that's nice to see. The Intercept, it's called. Good old Glenn Greenwald. All right, so here's the thing. Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill, they put out this piece, and I emailed Glenn Greenwald today, and I says, hey, would you do my radio show? And he says, no, can't do it. However, he's going to be on next week, he says, so that's pretty good. I haven't talked to Glenn in a while, so it'll be good to have him back on the show. But he said, what he said was, why don't you talk with, you could talk with Ryan Devereaux, who helped work on this piece, or get back to me early next week. Apparently he's got a big story coming out soon. I would bet on it. And so I said, both. I'm going to interview Ryan Devereaux today, and I'm going to interview you in a week. And so that's that. Ryan Devereaux is going to be on the show to talk about the NSA's secret role in the U.S. assassination program later on after my show's over. If you ain't already seen it, I suggest you go watch Greenwald and Scahill both this morning on Democracy Now! You can see the rerun there at democracynow.org. They do a real good job talking about all this stuff. I'm proud of those guys, man. They're sticking it to the man big time there. And this is a very important piece of work here. I won't spoil it for you. Except to say that it's all about the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command using NSA signals intelligence to target people for their drone strikes. You can read it for yourself, or, you know, bookmark it for later, or scratch your chin and reflect on what you remember reading in it this morning or last night, if you already read it. Whatever it is, begin anticipating. Our introduction to Ryan Devereaux. New somebody or other at firstlook.org, The Intercept. And co-author, researcher, something or other on this piece. So, good. And then, hey, should be that Glenn will be on the show, which will be the first time I've had a chance to speak with him since the whole Snowden thing broke out. So that'll be great. All right. Now, this coming Saturday, I'm giving a speech in Washington, D.C. If you want to go, cool. If you, it's at the Grand Hyatt, it's the International Students for Liberty Conference, and it's the FFF, the Future Freedom Foundation Conference, within a conference there, at the International Students for Liberty Conference at the Grand Hyatt, and I'll be speaking on Saturday afternoon sometime, something like that. Anyway, so please go to that. Also, if you're interested enough to want to go to it, why don't you go to facebook.com/Scott Horton Show and go and like and share on the thing where I say I'm giving a speech, because Facebook has this thing where they're trying to extort a bunch of money out of me now to show my page to the people who want to see it. I got 6,000-something people hit like on the thing. Well, sorta. Most of them were my friends first, and then I twisted that into, changed it into a like. But anyway, it's the same damn thing. And the assumption being that they want to see what I'm posting on my page. But Facebook, at least they're honest, and they tell me each time I post a post how few people they're showing it to. Which, I think my numbers probably weren't that much better back when I had the old kind of page. But anyway, the more you share it, and the more you like it, the more it'll let anybody else see it. So, if you want to go and see the talk that I'm giving with John Glazer, it'll be on libertarianism versus the empire at the Future Freedom Foundation event. And, hey, I haven't been to D.C. in a long time. I got a lot of interviewees and really, you know, honestly, good friends I've made over the years that live there. And hopefully I'm going to get a chance to meet a lot of them. And I've had word in the email and on Twitter and et cetera that there are fans of the show who, you know, I've been hearing from a long time, but I'll have a chance to meet for the first time, so that'll be really cool. That's this Saturday, February the 15th, at the International Students for Liberty Conference at the Grand Hyatt in Washington, D.C., at the Future Freedom Foundation Conference within a conference there. So go to my Facebook page and like it and share it so that other people, you know, I just know that this is going to happen. People are going to say, you were in D.C. giving a speech and I had no idea. Why didn't you post it on Facebook? And I'll say, well, I did, but out of the 6,000 people that wanted to see it, it only showed the post to 30 people. 33. All right. Anyway, so yeah, there's that. And then let me see here. Here's how I'm going to finish up this segment real quick-like. Is the U.S. powerless to stop the spread of Al-Qaeda? It's by James Rosen in McClatchy Newspapers, McClatchyDC.com. And yeah, it's just kind of an overview, sort of from a naive point of view, about how, yeah, Al-Qaeda's just spreading all over the place here. And is there anything we can do to make them stop? And nobody knows. And anyway, I just wanted to point out the thing that I guess you're still not supposed to say, or what have you, kind of thing. So I'll go ahead and make it a point to say, it's all the fault of the politicians that run the American empire. They're the ones who turned our friends, their old friends, the Mujahideen of the Afghan War of the 80s, against the American people with their horrible policies in Palestine and Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Egypt, etc. And they're the ones who have spread al-Qaeda and turned it from a group of 200 or 300 men on September 11th into thousands across the Middle East today, mostly by invading Iraq, stupid, and backing them in Syria and Libya. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for the Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for the Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And, yeah, that's right. 2014, a group of guys, al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and their few dozen closest friends, they were a few hundred people, 200-300 people, on September 10th and September 12th, 2001. And then, you know, the CIA and their friends, they pointed at, you know, their communist friends in the Northern Alliance, they pointed their laser designators at the al-Qaeda guys on the ground, and the U.S. Air Force dropped gigantic bombs on their head and blew them all the little bitty pieces, and it was only a couple of dozen of them escaped to Pakistan. Yeah, Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush, the, you know, master and commander, these guys, was that a movie? I don't know where I got that. These guys decided to surround al-Qaeda on three sides at Tora Bora and let them escape into Pakistan for 10 years. Total accident, you know, just because the Marines were only 10 miles away, 10,000 of them, and were raring to go and dying to go and begging for permission to go and were denied. You know, that doesn't mean anything or anything. It was just, you know, best they could do. But anyway, ever since then, by staying in Afghanistan, that's a huge part of it. That was bin Laden's plan in the first place, was to bring the United States into occupying Afghanistan. In fact, remember Anand Gopal, I think it was, reported on that letter that was found where bin Laden was saying to the Taliban after September 11th and the bombing campaign began that, I'm so sorry, I did not know it was going to be this bad. I really didn't. But trust me, 10 years from now, everything's going to be hilarious about how they fell right into our trap, and even though they came hardcore at first, that we're going to win anyway at the end. They're going to do what we want. They're going to go bankrupt at the end, just like in the plan. So bear with me, Mullah Omar. Don't be angry, he said. And anyway, and then so by staying in Afghanistan, and then especially by invading Iraq and overthrowing the Sunni minority secular fascist dictatorship of the Ba'athist Saddam Hussein there, and staying there and fighting that gigantic war to, you know, install the Shiite Arabs in power, or their political parties at least that they're stuck with in power in Baghdad, and to, you know, complete the sectarian cleansing of Baghdad. And this was, you know, Colleen Rowley, for example, who she and her team could have stopped September 11th if their bosses at the FBI had let them go to the FISA court, which would have definitely rubber stamped their request to search all of Zacharias Moussaoui's papers. She warned before September 11th in her whistleblowing in 2002. She warned in her letter to the Senate, invading Iraq is going to be the best thing for terrorists ever, ever. Don't do it. And that's just one example. Hosni Mubarak, her loyal sock puppet dictator in Egypt, said you're going to create 1,000 bin Ladens. What are you doing? Well, it's more like 10,000. Anyway, so they changed it from a group of people who were, you know, directly loyal in some kind of chain of command with bin Laden, who's now dead, or Ayman al-Zawahiri, his buddy, the Egyptian doctor. Now it's just a movement. It's just a name. All you got to do is be a Sunni Islamist and have a black flag and a gun, and you call yourself al-Qaeda, and you're a revolutionary. Fine. It's like a Che Guevara t-shirt for them. You know? And so, but who was it that accomplished all that for them? It was the United States. And so now, literally, I mean, imagine, could you, you know, I remember in, do you remember the triumphalism of 2001 and 2? Oh my God, we are going to obliterate these guys. And you would have thought it was the World War, like we were going to go and hem in the Germans again or something like that. A world war-sized war launched against 200 men, and all they did was spread it around. All they did was make it much worse. Like Mickey Mouse and his axe trying to stop the broom in Fantasia, and he just keeps chopping it up into smaller and smaller pieces, and then they just keep going, making his problems worse and worse and worse. And of course, you know, the whole terror war is bogus. They know that they're just creating terrorism as they chase it around and whatever. As Leon Panetta put it, hey, these are the tools we have, so these are the tools we got to keep using to do the very same thing. And you know what? Here's the thing of it, though. As bad as Iraq was, American support, Barack Obama's support, in alliance with the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, the Jordanians, the Israelis, in the French and other NATO countries, too, I'm sure the British as well, in supporting the al-Qaeda so-called revolution in Syria. This is the biggest thing in the world. I mean, this makes Ronald Reagan's adventure in Afghanistan and the horrible blowback suffered from that look like nothing. It's going to. And they're admitting it now. I mean, that's what they're saying. And of course, if you ask them, any new terrorism to come out of the Syrian war to spread against Western targets, American targets, Israeli targets, European targets of any kind, that'll always be the first day in the history of the world, and it'll only be a brand new reason to begin intervening again. Oh, you know what? All of a sudden, there's some kind of terrorist threat in Syria. And in fact, along those lines, there's a headline today on antiwar.com. U.S. inexplicably says Iran is backing the Syrian rebels. What? Well, that's funny. That's the same thing that they did in Iraq in 2007 when it was America and Iran were backing the Shiite parties against the Sunni-based insurgency the whole time. And then all of a sudden they started blaming Iran for every Sunni roadside bomb. Huh? And they never did explain why that made any sense at all, because they never had to explain whose side America was on over there in the first place, who was fighting for who in the first place. So there was no discrepancy for them to iron out, since the whole thing was just democracy, whatever. Don't ask questions about who's on whose side here. But this is exactly what they did in order to reorient the war, to turn the war around against Muqtada al-Sadr at that point, and pretend that he was the leader of the insurgency the whole time, when he'd been quiet most of the time, with a few exceptions where his guys had fought. But most of the time, the Sunni insurgency was the insurgency. Well, here they are, blaming Iran for the Sunni insurgency. So I don't know whether that means they're just want to use that against Iran, or whether they're coming up with a new excuse to stab their friends in the back, just like they did the Shiites in Iraq in 1991, build them up and then leave them high and dry in a giant bay of pigs. They doing that again in Syria? I guess we've been calling that for a year or more, right? Yeah, they're not really going to help these guys win. They're just going to help them keep fighting and killing and getting killed. But, you know, we could see a redirection here where, what's wrong with backing al-Qaeda in Syria now? Oh, they're backed by Iran, huh? Whatever. You know, if that's the ridiculous lie you need when we all know that Iran is backing the Shiite government, the Alawite government of Syria in alliance with Hezbollah against al-Qaeda there, whatever. If you got to say that lie in order to stop backing al-Qaeda in Syria, I guess I'll compromise. How about that, Democrats? Go ahead. Blame Iran for being behind Zawahiri's men. It's so funny. Zawahiri came out with that thing saying, oh, I'm going to spoil my punchline for that McAdams interview coming up. But anyway, Zawahiri put out a thing saying, hey, you know, all you jihadi warrior bin Ladenites in Syria, stop fighting amongst each other and get along. You have to work together to overthrow the evil, blasphemous Shiite government of Syria, backed by those Iranian dogs and the Russians and the Chinese. And of course, no mention of the great Satan, the Americans, because America's on Zawahiri's side in this one. Man, I really should have that Hillary clip to queue up each and every time, shouldn't I? Oh, no, you know what? I do have. Well, it's not right there queued up, but I bet you I can play it easy enough, Hillary. I don't think that's it, man. How come it's only pulling up this one, but not that one?
Despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a secretary of state and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable, we don't see that.
Yeah. And that was a long time ago. Oh, I see. I just needed to click on show seven more, sort of like this. Yeah, here we go. This is the one I want to play.
We know al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria?
Uh-huh. Yes, you are. That's exactly right. Have been. And man, the blowback from that is just going to be incredible, you know? You just, you know, even don't even bother Googling. Just picture your vague Eurasia that you have in your brain there. And just think, these guys were, you know, exiled to what they call the lion's den, their little hideout on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, on the ass end of the planet Earth. A couple of hundred guys. And then America has brought them all the way as far as the Mediterranean Sea now. Into Turkey, and the war is already spreading. Into Turkey, into Lebanon. Soon you'll have al-Qaeda's suicide bombings in Israel. Which, of course, they'll blame on the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank or whatever, right? Anyway. Yeah. Bad policy there. Will America ever get rid of al-Qaeda? No. You're doing it wrong. You want to get rid of the war on terrorism? You know, Philip Giraldi, he's a former CIA, DIA counterterrorism officer, writes for the American Conservative magazine, and he says, oh yeah, you want to destroy al-Qaeda like me. He wants to destroy al-Qaeda too. He says, you want to destroy him? Knock it off! Ramp this whole thing down. The less intervention, the less resistance to your intervention. And if there are, and there will of course be, I guess, some number, probably small, of diehard, hell-bent for revenge, incorrigible people who still want to attack the United States and, you know, bait us into further conflict over there, whatever, arrest them. Find them and arrest them and prosecute them. Call this whole thing off. It's very convenient for a bunch of arms manufacturers and a bunch of government job holders to pretend that there's some gigantic Soviet Union of terrorists out there. But the more you treat them like marginal loser criminals, the more you can get away with treating them that way. Instead of building them up, making them something that people want to copy and join up with, making their movement the vanguard of resistance to Western imperialism in the Middle East, making them look right about us, in other words. The best PR would be stop backing dictators over there. Stop backing revolutions over there. Stop threatening everybody with bombs all the time. Oops, I blew the brake, didn't I? Gotta go. Hey y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Our first guest on the show today is Chase Madar. He's a lawyer in New York, and he's the author of The Passion of Bradley Manning. I don't know if they're updating the cover of that thing or what, but it don't matter. It's a great book. You really ought to read it. Hey, sometimes people change their identities. You know, I don't care. Anyway... So, and that it really is a great book, too. I read the whole thing, and I highly recommend it to people if you want to understand the story of Bradley Manning and the origin of the WikiLeaks there. And, you know, hey, I hope especially it would inspire you to go digging through those State Department cables and those Iraq and Afghan war logs, et cetera. There's some great stories in those documents that are still to be told, even though, of course, thousands and thousands of great articles have been based on them so far. But anyway, so Chase, you got this great new piece at TomDispatch.com. It's all also running at antiwar.com. And it's The Folly of Arming Israel by, it's under Tom Engelhardt's name at antiwar.com. But it's about U.S. aid to Israel. And I guess sort of first and foremost here, can we just start off with the amounts? Or in fact, even before the amounts, we just talk about how nobody talks about this. I think it kind of comes through that this is part of why you wrote this is because you don't see anybody else writing it.
Yeah, virtually no one is addressing this. And it's a really important issue. I mean, we're constantly getting news coverage of this peace process in the Middle East between Israel and Palestine. And it's just assumed that the United States and Washington is some kind of a neutral player, honestly and earnestly trying to reconcile these two parties. But this clashes tremendously with the virtually unreported fact that the U.S. is giving $3.1 billion in military aid to Israel year after year. They're the top recipient of U.S. foreign aid over the past 30 years. And this is doubly weird because they are a wealthy country with a GDP per head that's pretty much on par with the European Union average. So how can we pretend that we are a neutral referee, a neutral arbiter in this conflict if we are putting a fist on the scales for one of the parties to the tune of $3.1 billion in advanced weaponry? And that weaponry is essential for Israel's domination and control of Palestine and the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza. It's incredibly significant. So that's why I wrote this piece. This whole question of giving military aid to Israel, lavish amounts of it, really needs to be debated searchingly because I don't think it's a good thing at all.
All right, now here's the thing about it too, as you say and as you write about in your piece, it just sort of goes without saying. It's not that it's a secret or anything like that. It just gets no coverage at all. It's treated, it's like Chomsky says about all the best propaganda. It's the unspoken premise. It's just the assumption, the false, or not necessarily, unanimous assumption behind all the arguments. And so there's just, if no one ever questions whether it's right to keep doing this, then it remains unquestionable, in the minds of people. And I don't say it very well, but it's a very powerful thing to have something just sort of off the shelf for discussion or off the table of discussion. That's only, you know, outside of the goalposts of what's acceptable, you know?
Yeah. I mean, U.S. aid to Israel and to a lesser degree, U.S. aid to Egypt, that's the second biggest recipient of U.S. foreign aid over the past 30 years. It's taken in foreign policy elites to be just part of the natural order of the universe. You don't question it any more than you question, say, the Mississippi River or, because it's just a fact of nature, like the force of gravity or something. Now, when occasionally people do question it, there's a whole arsenal of incredibly creaky, tired, disingenuous arguments to defend it. I mean, one of them is that, oh, well, we have to give Israel $3.1 billion in advanced weaponry every year because they're our ally. Now, of course, we have dozens of allies all over the world, but we don't arm them to the teeth like we do Israel. Or another one, and this one's my favorite, is that if we don't heavily arm Israel, then we will be retreating back into isolationism.
Wait a minute. Go back. Let's get back to isolationism, because that's a good one. I like it. But on the they are our ally, there's that unsaid assumption, right, is that if we weren't giving them all these weapons, they would be extinct. They would all be killed. This is necessary.
Yeah.
Since we are our ally, we are bound to give them as much as is necessary for them to survive, even though nobody ever proves that bogus assumption underlying the argument.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's just assumed that they depend for their survival of their people on massive infusions of U.S. aid. And, you know, that's pretty potent emotional blackmail, especially after a century of truly genocidal anti-Semitism. I mean, you can see why that sticks and why playing that card works. It's not a rational argument, though, and they do not depend on American aid for their survival or their security. By now, Israel has an incredibly powerful and thoroughly modern military, the biggest and most potent military in the region, the most advanced, including nuclear weapons, which they've had since the late 60s.
So, well, that's why you got to leave that assumption unsaid. Because
Once
you say it out loud, you go, well, no, that's not true. They're as powerful as, you know, France or something militarily. What are you talking about?
Yeah. So, I mean, the idea that they depend on military aid for security and survival is totally bogus. And I think it really has a negative effect in encouraging really bad behavior on the part of successive Israeli governments across the political spectrum to keep up their violent colonization and ethnic cleansing of historic Palestine. After all, if you're going to get year after year this free gratis supply of weapons, no matter what you do, you have no incentive to change your behavior in any way. And that's what we've seen.
Right. Well, and you know, when you talk about the $3.5 billion a year, they even passed an appropriation, which I guess, you know, the money is to be doled out on a yearly basis or maybe a biannual basis or something. But the bill itself guaranteed $30 billion over the next 10 years plus.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing that is banned by the U.S. Constitution when you're talking about the Congress appropriating money to the military. Any military appropriation can only be for 2 years at a time, max. There's just too much incentive to build them up into a permanent, you know, collection of job holders. But when it comes to Israel, no, we'll pass a law promising them welfare just into the indefinite future.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and another bogus argument that's related to this is that Israel is this wonderful strategic asset to the United States, that, in fact, we depend on giving all this aid to Israel because it benefits our security, and that it, having Israel there, loyally cashing checks and receiving our shipments of military material is somehow good for us. This doesn't stand to reason either. Even if you accept Washington's foreign policy on its own terms, which, you know, you and I don't, but a lot of people do. You know, let's think about how was this client-state relationship with Israel actually useful in either Gulf War? Can that be explained in two senses? No, it can't be. It's also very, you know, well-established, and you hear this from unguarded moments from U.S. military officers as well as terrorists that our funding relationship, our lavish donations of military aid to Israel really inspire a lot of ill will towards the United States and direct a lot of wrath and, in the end, terrorism against American targets. It promotes anti-Americanism in the region. And that does not make us safer, needless to say.
Right. Well, and, you know, this is why I got such a chip on my shoulder about it, is because of, you know, just very straight journalism. For example, like by Terry McDermott, L.A. Times reporter, and Lawrence Wright, reporter for the New York Times. When these guys write, or James Bamford, for that matter, when these former producer for, you know, World News Tonight with Peter Jennings, this kind of caliber of journalism, these guys write that, hey, it's just a scientific fact, man. There's no disputing it, and they don't have a bone to pick about it. They're just reporting the fact to you that Bin Laden himself and Mohammed Atta said that the reason that they did what they did on 9/11 was due in great part to America's support for the Israelis, and not for their existence, and not for being a bunch of nice guys, but for their permanent, at that point at least, occupation of southern Lebanon, and their occupation of Palestine, and East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. And the hell that they unleash on their Palestinian helots on a constant basis. That was part of it. In fact, Israel's war in Lebanon, where they did the Qana massacre, at that same time was when Mohammed Atta, I think it was the day before or something, they say, Mohammed Atta filled out his last will and testament. And then Bin Laden, when he put out his first declaration of war, the Qana massacre in Lebanon and a lot of the rest of Palestine issues take up about a third of that thing. Is this is why they're attacking the United States, because of what we're doing in Palestine. So I'm not saying that's necessarily why we should not back Israel, but boy, we ought to have to take into account that that's the price we're paying for backing Israel.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have to take a hard look at the strategic costs and benefits when it comes to lavishly arming and bankrolling Israel. And the question of the liabilities, which you just listed, you know, perfectly, are, I mean, that's something that seldom comes up, and most Americans are oblivious to it, even though it has been reported, you know, from pretty unimpeachable sources, too. It's not every foreign policy issue where concern for human rights and kind of basic morality are in pretty perfect alignment with questions of strategy and national self-interest and security. But this is one of them. I mean, we get nothing out of lavishly bankrolling Israel. But the human rights cost is huge, I mean, with the ongoing ethnic cleansing of the West Bank, and the blockade of Gaza and the ethnic cleansing of East Jerusalem on the one hand, plus the strategic liability to the U.S. There's really no good reason for it.
All right, y'all. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Chase Madar. He's the author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, and he's got this great piece at TomDispatch.com and Antiwar.com about USA to Israel, the folly of arming Israel. We'll be right back after this. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Chase Madar, author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, and this great piece at TomDispatch.com and at Antiwar.com. It's called The Folly of Arming Israel. And let's see, we're talking about, the general strategic liability of Israel. We hear all this hype really loud about, oh, it's the only democracy in the Middle East. Never mind, America always cancels anybody else's elections because they never turn out the way the Israelis wanted. But, oh, so that makes them our bestest friends. But again, with the unspoken assumptions and premises of these questions, nobody ever really explains what a great benefit America gets for being friends with the Israelis. And I try real hard to be honest and self-critical and whatever is best I can, and I really try, and I don't know what benefit. Can anybody tell me what America gets out of this relationship as far as even the empire's interest, Washington, D.C.'s interest, never mind, you know, the greater wealth and freedom and prosperity of the American people? You know, I just don't know. Do you, Chase?
I don't see it either, Scott. No way. In my article, one thing I try to do is just to correct the language about how we talk about the U.S. relationship with Israel, because there's so much euphemism and so much disingenuous half-truth and some outright lies here. One thing, we need to stop talking about Israel as an ally and call it for what it is, a client state. We also need to stop talking about a peace process when we're arming one side in the conflict to the teeth. What we have is a war process. And instead of talking about settlement expansion, we need to use words like violent colonization and ethnic cleansing, because that's what it is. And I have a feeling that if this kind of thing were happening in the Balkans or elsewhere, we would have no trouble using those words.
Well, and you know, the way you put it in your article, you win. I can't imagine what anybody could say to the argument of what if you just turned it around and it was the Arabs are coming and pushing the Jews out of their houses and bulldozing them, on 5 minutes' notice and building a museum of their hurt feelings on top of your cemetery and all this kind of crap, the way the Israelis are doing, taking Jerusalem, the old city of Eastern Jerusalem and all that in the West Bank. If it was the other way around, people would be completely freaking out. Can you imagine?
I mean, there would be calls for airstrikes in Washington. I mean, people would be freaking out. And, you know, justifiably so.
Yeah, exactly. It would be horrible, right?
You know, what's going on right now on a day-to-day basis and what's getting done to Palestinians is horrible. It's an absolute violation of their most basic human rights. For whatever it's worth, it's a violation of international law, and it's certainly a violation of just any basic standard of morality or common decency. And, what we Americans really need to know and absorb and internalize is that we are not just sitting on the sidelines as a friendly referee trying to make peace. We are actively involved in this nightmare. And we are actively arming a country that is committing ethnic cleansing. There's no way around that. No matter what kind of rich palette of euphemism you use, that's the bottom line. We are lavishly arming and bankrolling and providing diplomatic cover to a country that is perpetrating ethnic cleansing. Mm-hmm. And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, the first step is just to recognize our own responsibility in this and change our own role. You know, there's a lot of lively intellectual debate in the U.S. about the BDS campaign, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people of goodwill disagree on it. Me, I think it's a good thing. I'm all for it. But I know smart people who don't agree with me there. There's also a lot of debate about, is a one-state solution for Israel and Palestine the best, where they'd have equal rights, or a two-state solution, where you have one country for the Israelis and one for the Palestinians? But the one thing that does not get discussed, and I find this incredibly weird, is our own active role, because that is what we are most responsible for in the end. What we are doing, not what we're not doing. And that's why I wrote this piece. We just have to look at this front and center, our vigorous role in giving $3.1 billion to Israel year after year in advanced military equipment, not to mention military training exercises, a lot of military research for the Iron Dome Missile Defense Project, and constant diplomatic cover in the UN and elsewhere. Right. We're a major player in this game, and yet we pretend that we aren't. And in the piece, I compared most U.S. news coverage of Israel-Palestine to this one Agatha Christie novel. I'm going to spoil an Agatha Christie novel for everyone. People may want to, you know, turn off the set for a little bit. But there's this great Agatha Christie novel called The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, and it's narrated in the first person from this very calm, semi-detached voice of a guy who's, you know, observing the action, commenting on it, telling the story. And guess who turns out to be the killer, the narrator? And that's a good, I think, metaphor for so much U.S. news coverage of the Middle East in general, but especially the Israel-Palestine conflict.
All right. Well, so there's this article today. It's in the Times of Israel, which is a pretty right-wing paper. I don't know everything about who runs it or whatever, but it seems pretty right-wing paper to me. And they say, on a single source, unverified, they even admit, but it sounds right, Kerry fails to get Obama backing to confront Israel on peace terms. And what it says is that Kerry really wanted to go in there and tell the Israelis, look, man, come on, make a deal within this framework, whatever his stupid framework is and whatever, and that, but he just doesn't have the backing of the White House to, you know, make any threat or any promise really stick. And the reason I buy it is because this is what Andrew Coburn reported, was that Obama will be damned if John Kerry's going to solve this Israel-Palestine thing and take all the credit instead of him. And he'd rather they all burn forever than let John Kerry be the big man of the day or whatever. So that's fine. I could see how that works, you know, all like that among Democrats. But so then my question is this. I actually have a question after all this, is that after this falls apart and doesn't work, and the peace process is a joke for the umpteenth millionth time, whatever it is, does it matter that in the EU or, I don't know, Eastern allies or any other powers on earth, does it matter that, come on, it's too difficult to pretend that we believe that the Americans mean well and are some kind of honest broker here? I mean, I know there's the BDS movement, but as far as the nation states of, you know, that have any power and influence here, does it matter if the Americans basically, it's not the right term for it, but bluff their way out of legitimacy as the dealer at the game? You know what I mean?
You know, I think that the sooner the U.S. stops pretending to be a neutral arbiter and an honest broker here, the better. It's just past the point of any possibility for Washington to realistically broker something. And, you know, I've got to read is it a Patrick Coburn article?
No, it's Andrew Coburn.
Andrew Coburn. I mean, they're both really smart guys, and I love their work. I think it's just structurally impossible, even if Obama or Kerry, you know, work together and put their all into resolving this, you can't put your foot on the gas and on the brake at the same time and expect to make any kind of progress. And that's what we're doing. On the one hand, lavishly funding and bankrolling Israel, no matter what they do. And then on the other hand, you know, spinning wheels and saying you're working for peace. They don't go together. I mean, you can't, you're not part of a peace process if you're lavishly arming one side. And think about it. I mean, if you were Israel, why on earth would you make any compromises and accept any limits on your power if you know that you're still going to get that sweet shipment of $3.1 billion worth of advanced weaponry year after year, no matter what you do? The level of American military funding and assistance to Israel is only going up, and Obama bragged, you know, and he was completely accurate, that no president has overseen as much military aid to Israel as he has. So they have no incentive in Israel to make any compromises, to make any peace, and they'll be happy to, you know, let this go away. Now, in the past, when a peace deal collapses and fails, it's been the habit in the U.S. to blame it all on the weakest party in this trio, the Palestinian. That's going to be a little harder to do this time. I mean, there's just nothing left to squeeze out of them at this point. More and more people are reporting on how Netanyahu and his cabinet members are just openly contemptuous of John Kerry and even of Obama. And they're not a very, cuddly, fuzzy group of people the way, say, the old Labor Party people were to many American intellectuals. There's going to be, a real test of America's journalistic creativity to find a way to blame this on the Palestinians. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Or, they'll just oversimplify it and make it the unproven, unspoken assumption that you know how them savage Arabs are, and no offer's ever good enough for them. They don't ever have to prove it. They just say it, and everybody digs it. It sounds right to people, I guess. I don't know. I'm sorry, I want to keep talking to you, but I got to go. We're all out of time. Thanks very much for your time on the show again, Chase.
Great talking with you again, Scott. Take care now.
All right, y'all. That is the great Chase Madar. He's a lawyer in New York, but he's still great. He's the great Chase Madar. Writes for Tom Dispatch. He's also the author of The Passion of Bradley Manning. Great book about Bradley Manning and the WikiLeaks there. The State Department cables and all that, you should know. So after this break, Dan McAdams interview on Ukraine, and then Ryan Devereaux on the new Greenwald project and their first piece about the NSA and the drone strikes. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. For Pacifica Radio, February 9th, 2014, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. All right, y'all, welcome to the show. It is Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton, here every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. My website is scotthorton.org. You can find all my interview archives there, more than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. Today's guest is Daniel McAdams. He is Executive Director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity at ronpaulinstitute.org, and before that was Ron Paul's foreign policy advisor in his congressional office for many years. Welcome to the show, Daniel. How are you doing?
Thanks a lot, Scott. Good to be with you again.
Very happy to have you on the show here. And the big news out of Ukraine is this clip of Victoria Nuland, Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, on the phone with Greg Pyatt, or Jeff Pyatt, sorry, ambassador to Ukraine. And what made the headline, of course, was the use of the F word. I guess I'll let you give a very brief description of the context, but then I have a few clips to play for the people here so that they can understand what we're talking about.
Yeah, and as your listeners probably know, Scott, she is Mrs. Robert Kagan. Her husband's, of course, the well-known neoconservative. And just to show you that our foreign policy is bipartisan, she's a former foreign affairs advisor to Dick Cheney, our favorite neocon. So they get around. But what happened, and probably a lot of people have heard about it now, but there was a phone call made between Assistant Secretary Nuland and the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine, during which they discussed in incredible detail the future makeup of a post-coup Ukrainian government. And what's interesting is they threw the names of the opposition leaders around in a very casual way, as if they knew them very intimately through a long period of acquaintanceship. You know, Klitschko was Klitsch, and this sort of thing. There's nobody who can listen to this clip and not see that this is not just the U.S. meddling in Ukrainian affairs, fiddling around with this or that. This is a deep attempt by the U.S. to have control over the future Ukrainian government after the overthrow of the current regime.
Oh, they're certainly talking about the place like they own it. Not even the 51st state, but maybe just a county in a state that they own somewhere. Let's listen to a couple of these clips here real quick, Dana.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Klitsch and Tony Book on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think Klitsch going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay, good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
So, again, that's just sort of the context, the tone of voice here. Yeah, well, and they're talking about two different guys from their side, right? The opposition the current president of Ukraine has tried to compromise and invite them into the government. And so they're talking about, you know, in which order they ought to join the government and in which rank these two different, you know, basically front men of theirs, correct?
Yeah, in a way, but they go beyond that even. They're talking about putting together a deal and talking about pulling in Ban Ki-moon or someone from the UN to, quote, glue the deal.
Mm-hmm. Here's that clip right here.
Okay.
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write you that this morning?
Yeah, okay. I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very politely censored by your gracious host here.
Well done.
Victoria Nuland, again, the Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs. She's on the phone with the American ambassador to Ukraine, and she's saying, F the EU. I talked with Ban Ki-moon, and he's going to send over, I don't know who this guy is, if you know who he is, and he's going to go over there, and he's going to work our magic in Ukraine, because we're tired of waiting around for the EU to get the regime change done, is basically what they're saying there, correct?
Yeah, exactly. And this Feltman that she talks about is at the UN now, but not long ago he was in the State Department. So this just goes to show how the U.S. really does run the United Nations. You know, look how Ban Ki-moon, when the U.S. said jump on the Iran invitation to Geneva II, they said how high, you know, i.e. they rescinded the invitation in the same day that they had extended it. So here you have a senior State Department official sliding over to the UN and helping to, quote, glue this deal that they're putting together in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. So and then I got one more clip here, and then I really want to give you free rein to explain the context of this as much as you want. We can get into the whole Cold War with Russia and everything. But just so that people understand the context here, I think the end of the conversation is sort of the cherry on top for, you know, this isn't just a couple of State Department flunkies talking. This is these are two of the very most powerful people in the State Department, or certainly she is, and she's talking to the Ukrainian ambassador, the guy in charge running this, you know, that part of the operation anyway. And they're saying, oh, don't worry, we'll get the vice president to come in, and he'll, you know, they'll do what he says. We'll make sure.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me, VFR, saying, you need Biden, and I said, probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
Okay, great. All right. Thanks.
So Biden's willing. And again, what exactly is it that they want Biden to give attaboy to who for doing what now again, Dan?
Well, the entire context is not clear, but it sounds to me like, you know, this organization of opposition leaders and how they see them working together, some sort of a deal. You know, there are, among some of the opposition parties, there is some tension. All seem to me at least to be quite extreme, certainly by our standards, but some are more extreme than others. And you have personalities. The Europeans, especially the Germans, are a lot more favorable toward Vitali Klitschko. And the U.S., at least from listening to this and from other things that I've read, seems somewhat reticent about him as sort of the top guy. So, you know, it's sort of ironing out the details. The assumption is that they're going to get the overthrow and we'll have this in place to take power afterward.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so let's rewind a little bit to last November and how the current controversy broke out. I guess, as far as I know, there's still people out in the streets protesting and rioting and who knows what. But what exactly, you know, back up a little bit, a broader context here.
Sure. Well, you know, back in November, there was a surprise decision by President Yanukovych to postpone signing the association agreement with the EU. And that would have brought Ukraine into sort of a free trade bloc with the EU. What hasn't been much reported is that what Ukraine wanted was to have a sort of the best of both worlds in a way. They wanted to have some sort of a free trade deal with Russia as well as with the EU. And, you know, it sounds good to a lot of people, you know, because Ukraine is in a very, interesting and strategic position. But the EU said, no dice. You've got to, you know, it's our way or the highway. So he hesitated. And right at this hesitation, and, you know, it's not for me to say whether it was a good deal or a bad deal. The EU offered, maybe a couple $100 million. Russia offered $15 billion. But the other component, and this is Professor Stephen Cohen, you probably know who he is, up in New York. He did an interview with Democracy Now! Last week, which was very interesting. He pointed out, and I hadn't seen anyone else do this, he pointed out that the agreement with the EU also contained language that would have brought the Ukrainian military in line with NATO military. So they didn't really want that to get out as much. But that brings a whole new wrinkle to this idea that it was just a little trade deal. This is bringing NATO troops, you know, basically to Russia's border.
Well, and that might explain why the Russians were willing to pay so much to have them break the deal.
That could be part of it. You know, that could be part of it. It was... Ukraine is obviously in need of a pretty serious bailout. Its prime trading partner is Russia. And, there was the deal to buy Ukrainian bonds and this sort of thing, prop up the currency. But whatever the case, last minute decided I'm going to hesitate on this. And as if by magic, these mobs appeared in the streets. Everyone says they were peaceful at first, but there are photographs of them using heavy chains to beat up on the police. The police admittedly did respond with force, as they do everywhere. I mean, try beating up on some Capitol Hill cops up here in D.C. with chains and see what happens. Not to excuse police brutality, but there certainly was violence on both sides from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And, this got out of hand. It settled down over Christmas, and then... Come late January, the so-called anti-protest laws were passed, and that seemed to give new impetus for a far more violent reaction against the police. Mm-hmm. And we've seen,
now,
I think, three
or four. Here's one thing I don't understand, even so far in the narrative. If it's a disputed election, like the Orange, so-called Orange Revolution of 2004, where, you know, Bush versus Gore and the guy that you were for lost or whatever, that I can understand people rioting over that or you know, forming massive protests over that. But the failure of the signing of a trade deal, that sounds like a lot to get people, you know, really out there. Is it their opposition, you know, this part of the population's opposition to moving back toward Russia? Is that the problem for them?
Well, it also makes you wonder if whether or not this was set up from the beginning. You know,
yeah, the whole thing's just an Iranian rent a mob like 1953 kind of thing, huh?
Yeah, yeah, it does. It does seem to, because as you say, it doesn't seem to rise to this existential level of you know, being willing. You know, these tensions have been in Ukraine for quite some time. you know, it goes back to 1939 when Hitler and Stalin decided how to carve up Ukraine. And so you do have these fault lines, and you have you know, a very differing view of people. But the question is, you know, Victoria Nuland herself said in a speech not long ago, she admitted that the U.S. had spent, quote, $5 billion to democratize Ukraine since the 90s. So it's a pretty strong admission that we are trying to manipulate things to the U.S.'s perceived advantage.
Well, and when you talk about the part of the trade deal that says they've got to start standardizing their military to fit with NATO, that's the key to this whole thing. Here, the assistant secretary's opinion is F the EU, and yet what she's so upset about is that she wants Ukraine so badly to join this pact with the EU. Clearly, this is the real question is lurking in the background, NATO expansion, which I had thought, Dan, that they had backed down from that goal, as it's, you know, completely insane and makes no sense whatsoever. They've already got Poland. They're already up to Russia's border in a few places, and they know that the Russians have a real thing about Ukraine there. Why push it, really?
Sure. Well, I mean, we saw this in 2008 with Georgia, too, though. The U.S., thank God Georgia wasn't in the wasn't in NATO at the time. But, you know, there have been people, John McCain being chief among them, but certainly a lot of the neocons want Georgia in NATO. So it really is a defiance of, you know, of agreements, of so-called gentlemen's agreements made with Gorbachev in the 80s that, you know, if you let these countries go, we promise we won't expand NATO. Well, that, you know, that hasn't been the case at all. And it's actually, as one of our academic advisors, Professor Mark Allman, said, I think last week on RT, this is effectively moving the Berlin Wall, you know, right up to Moscow, which is an extraordinarily provocative act.
Well, and you know, here's the thing of it, too. Correct me if you think I'm wrong here, but it seems to me like this is a big fake alliance anyway. Would America go to war for England, France, Spain, you know, Italy, probably Germany? Yeah. But to save Eastern Europe, to save Poland from, you know, say, you know, Putin Jr. or whatever, who comes and decides he's going to reinvade Eastern Europe, we're really going to get into a nuclear war? The line used to be West Germany, and that was the point where, you know, you figure Ronald Reagan really would have gotten in a war with them if they had tried to move into West Germany, something like that. But they sat back and did nothing when the Soviets cracked down in Hungary, and they said, sorry, Hungary, we're not giving up Washington, D.C. and New York City and Denver and Dallas for Hungary. You're, you know, it's a sorry fact of geography for you, pal. So really, this whole NATO alliance is, or I don't know, do you think that's really changed? You think they would, you know, get into a war for any of these, you know,
well,
Baltic states,
on the
European,
other hand,
Eastern European nations?
Sure. I was going to say, on the other hand, nobody thought Austria, Hungary, and Germany would go to war for Sarajevo. Nobody thought, you know, the UK and France would go to war over Poland in 1939. So these things can happen, and also miscalculations can cause nations, can cause wars as well.
Yeah.
And they have almost caused many wars, and they may well cause this one. So it's, you know, I think there's certainly a very good possibility that this could happen. And look at the U.S. arrogance. And you can hear arrogance in every word of this tape, but you can see arrogance in the U.S. foreign policy from Libya to Syria. You know, look at the Libya U.N. Security Council resolution. We told the Russians, oh, don't worry, this doesn't include force. You know, don't worry. And then, you know, the ink wasn't dry when we were bombing already. So combining the two, you know, I think something could be said for that.
All right, it's Daniel McAdams. He's the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Liberty at ronpaulinstitute.org. And speaking of Syria, I was wondering if you could give us your take on the recent talks in Geneva. I had thought, you know, there were some tea leaves to be read or something that I had thought indicated that they had sort of kind of at least come to their senses and figured that, you know, the best that, and I mean the American, you know, foreign policy departments up there, The best that they could hope for would be sort of a long-term, low-level civil war, but certainly not an outright victory by those attempting to depose Assad, who are, you know, ultimately they're basically the Sunni-based insurgency from Iraq, and the worst of them, the prisoner beheaders and the suicide bombers of marketplaces and that kind of thing. And then they go to Geneva, and John Kerry says, Assad must go, from the very get-go, when he knows that's the deal killer.
Yeah.
I guess I was just wrong in the first place, huh?
Well, I think the U.S. was always under the delusions that somehow, you know, the Assad government would go there and agree to some sort of a deal. Who knows what they may have done to try to bribe some of these guys who were there. You never know. But it was clear to, I mean, I'm sure it was clear to you, but it was, you know, it seemed awfully clear that this was an absurd deal, you know, and that, as you say, that what they should have been able to hope for were a few of the minor things that they were discussing, you know, some relief to some of these besieged cities and some, you know, some gestures. But, you know, these sides are nowhere near being close together, you know. So I just don't see the point of it. I never saw the point of it. And besides, the opposition was represented by a tiny microscopic faction that had absolutely no say on the ground as far as what happens. They didn't control the troops.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, you know, the best I can tell, like, for example, talking with David Enders from McClatchy Newspapers, where in the Iraq War, you really had the Sunni tribes of the Anbar province doing the fighting, and what was called al-Qaeda in Iraq was really, you know, 2-3% of them, and mostly the foreigners from Saudi Arabia and Syria and Libya who had come there to help fight. But when it came time to accept the deal to take the money and the guns and marginalize from the Americans and marginalize al-Qaeda in the ceasefire of 07, then they marginalized al-Qaeda. Look at the split. It was up to them. They were the super majority. But in Syria, you know, it depends on how loosely you use the term al-Qaeda. But basically, I mean, the berserkers, the suicide bomber, prisoner beheader crazies, this is their war in Syria. It always has been. It's not just the Sunni tribes. Apparently, you know, at least a substantial minority, if not a majority, of the Sunni Arabs of Syria, if they're not outright backing Assad, they're not on the side of these guys doing the fighting. And so there really is no one to go to Geneva to represent the insurgents. How are you going to bring a bunch of suicide bombers to Geneva? Prince Bandar can put his shock troops in Syria, but he can't take them back out again. Who can? Ayman al-Zawahiri can't even tell him what to do. Dan?
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. I mean, you can only wash these guys up so much and put them in a suit. You know, if people saw the real face of them, they'd be shocked. So it's, you know, they're left. I mean, they're sort of prisoners of their own delusions. I mean, the U.S., they think, and they know very well that when they send these weapons over to the so-called moderates, they're immediately stolen by the radicals and extremists. You know, this has happened over and over again. And yet, as you say, right as they were holding these Geneva talks, the U.S. was actively shipping more weapons over there. And you've probably seen, like I have, some recent photos out of Syria that show these guys with some pretty sophisticated handheld missiles and things as well. So they're definitely finding their supplies from somewhere, let's put it that way.
Well, it's just amazing, too, to troll through the headlines on antiwar.com, for example, where they talk about how U.S. is doubling down their support for Maliki and the Shiite Arab government of Iraq in alliance with Iran to fight against al-Qaeda. At the very same time, they're shipping weapons and money to the al-Qaeda fighters in Syria, and they're admonishing Maliki for allowing Iran to use Iraqi airspace to ship weapons to Assad for the very same fight.
Yeah,
it's just
exactly.
Absolutely,
and
incredible to see this going on all on the same day.
You know, what else is funny, one of my favorite sites is Moon of Alabama, and they had a couple of quotes from Kerry and Zawahiri, you know, from just a couple of months apart, and both of them were urging the rebels in Syria to do the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, we're encouraging you to stick together and find common ground and mend your differences. If you read the quotes, you'd get a huge laugh out of it. Here's
That's
the Secretary
great.
Of State and the head of al-Qaeda pushing the same policy in Syria.
Right. One of Zawahiri's recent messages from just, I think, last week was, come together to fight against the evil Baathist regime of Syria, which is backed by the Russians and the Chinese, and notably absent from his list, the Americans, who you might have thought were al-Qaeda's number one enemies. But in this case, and you know, it's funny too, did you see the Josh Rogan piece where in the Daily Beast, where I think it was McCain and Graham or Mick Graham, whatever, talking Josh Rogan, they said, well, they had an off-the-record meeting with John Kerry, which his spokesman pretty much confirmed the details of, I think. Which, where Kerry said, listen, the al-Qaeda fighters in Syria are becoming a real threat, so we're going to, and our policy thus far has failed, so we're going to have to really double down on support for the moderates.
Yeah, exactly. Where,
not that I'm an imperialist and I'm saying they should switch sides back to Assad and the Baathists, who used to work for George Bush as loyal employees torturing and killing al-Qaeda guys. But, you know, of course, I recommend non-intervention. But if you're John Kerry and you have to intervene somewhere in Syria, it would seem like the natural thing to do would be to back the secular fascists against the suicide bomber bin Ladenites.
I mean, it's like me saying, you know, these four shots of vodka I took seem to be getting me drunk, so I better double down and take some more so hopefully won't get drunk. You know, it's just insane to double up on the things that you're doing that are causing the problems. But you know what else Kerry is doing is he's blaming Assad for the rise of al-Qaeda in Syria. It's somehow Assad's fault. And even going so far as to saying that he's letting the al-Qaeda have victories so that he can point to the fact that al-Qaeda is strong in his country. And, you know, I mean, that seems pretty delusional to me.
Yeah, of course. Well, and this is John Kerry, who, back when they were trying to get us into the war last summer, testified to John McCain, and the whole, you know, studio audience there on Capitol Hill broke out into guffaws when he said, oh, no, the vast majority of the rebellion there are moderate secularists, and it's just this tiny percentage that are the jihadists. When, you know, even when John McCain went over there and met with those guys, he was meeting with the Northern Storm Brigade, who they told Time magazine, yeah, we're veterans of the Iraq War, where we fought the Americans there.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, also, to go back to where we started, Scott, is that there are incredible parallels with Ukraine. You know, McCain was over there recently having dinner with Tianibok, who is, you know, there's a picture of him doing a Hitler salute. You know, it's no secret this guy is an extremist, a neo-Nazi, and the U.S. is supporting extreme anti-Semitic
All right, sorry, everybody, we got to go. You can find this whole interview of the great Dan McAdams at scotthorton.org/interviews. scotthorton.org/interviews. We'll be right back with Ryan Devereaux from The Intercept right after this.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and despite all the stuff exploding in the world, really the biggest story is last today, and that is the launch of The Intercept, which is the first part of the First Look Media project of the zillionaire Pierre Omidyar, and the one that I care about, the one put together by Glenn Greenwald, Jeremy Scahill, and Laura Poitras. And on the line is Ryan Devereaux. He's one of the journalists on the very short list to start out with The Intercept, and he contributed to their first piece, the NSA secret role in the U.S. assassination program. It's at firstlook.org/theintercept. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on.
Very happy to have you here, and very happy to see this project moving forward. I'm sort of vicariously shaking in the boots of all the mainstream media people. I read a hilarious hit piece on Glenn Greenwald today at the Daily Beast, where he even has parentheses at the end of his accusation saying, actually, this isn't really right. And then moving on. And anyway, I'm just having a great time seeing this. It's the anticipation is as good as the journalism. It's a lot of
Thank
fun.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, good deal. All right, so... and I have to add here how great it is that Marcy Wheeler is a part of this. And I would have been amazed and disappointed if they had not brought her on board. But that's how to make sure that all of your paragraphs are completely factually correct, is to have her look at them. If you ask me, she's sort of the ultimate check on what especially these government documents really say, as you well
Marcy
know, of course.
Marcy's unreal. She's a machine. She can just crank out these articles every day. They're so detail-packed. It's a privilege, a real honor and privilege to be working with her.
Yeah. She put aside her modesty, which she is very modest, but she put aside for just a moment the other day to list, here's some of the stuff that I got right that was later proved right about the NSA. These are not, you know, this isn't just, you know, great journalism she's done. These are all the things where she's saying, you know, I bet we're going to later find out X, and then that's exactly what comes out later. And the list is 20 long, and it's all the highest caliber stuff, of course. This is incredible stuff. So anyway, congratulations. May you, you know, live long outside of the walls of Guantanamo Bay Prison and prosper in your journalism. Great. So now... let's talk about this piece. It's the NSA's secret role in the U.S. assassination program. Tell us first about your sourcing for this piece.
Well, so the story is really based on three sources, three separate sources. Of course, there are the documents that former NSA contractor Edward Snowden leaked last year that Dick Lane has been reporting on for the last 6-7 months or so. So there's a number of documents there that contribute to the report that we published today. And then there's a new source, a former analyst with the National Security Agency and a former drone operator with the military's elite Joint Special Operations Command, who came forward to describe some of the programs that he was involved in, spoke under conditions of anonymity with us, sort of describe the way in which the NSA works alongside Joint Special Operations Command and the Central Intelligence Agency to sort of track people for drone strikes and night raids around the world in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. And then our third source, sort of backing up the other two, is a young man named Brandon Bryant. He's a former Air Force drone sensor operator. He was in the Air Force for 6 years, beginning in 2005, flew missions over Afghanistan, Iraq, and eventually Yemen, worked alongside conventional forces, and then eventually worked alongside JSOC in Yemen in the hunt for Anwar al-Awlaki. He got out shortly before the Central Intelligence Agency took over the hunt for al-Awlaki and killed him in September of 2011. Bryant has sort of come forward as a outspoken critic of the United States targeted killing policy. So together, sort of put those three sources together, the documents, the Snowden documents, this NSA JSOC guy, and Brandon sort of comments, built a picture of what the NSA's role in targeted killing around the world looks like.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, so I'm really glad that I asked you that, because I thought I had your three sources, but you've clarified, I believe, that other than the documents, your second source that you talked about there, the unnamed JSOC operator, that he himself was a former NSA. So he's both.
Yes.
So he was giving you both sides of the picture. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah, really, really unique source. And then, he can sort of speak to both sides of this sort of equation. Whereas with Brandon, I spent a good amount of time talking to Brandon, and he was very interesting because these programs are so compartmentalized. And Brandon has this Air Force, what he called a stick monkey, basically the sensor operator, is the guy who runs the cameras for a drone. So he shines the laser, if you will, on the target, and then someone else takes the shot. But Brandon, didn't really have any idea who was providing the intelligence to his crew when he was working in places like, Afghanistan, Iraq and Yemen, but this other source that we had, you know, had a very unique experience of sort of seeing the intelligence side of things as well as the Joint Special Operations Command, really, you know, the most elite sort of military command out there. Mm-hmm.
All right, so now the bottom line of the story really here is that there's a high demand for dead bodies at the hands of drone operators, so they got to come up with lists of people to kill, and the way that they come up with the list is what?
Well, so what our story talks about is the way in which the National Security Agency has developed this technology for analyzing metadata and tracking cell phones, which basically allows them, with a sort of device that's on the bottom of a drone, to track a person's cell phone within 30 feet of their actual location. And what our source revealed, our NSHA source revealed that was so disturbing about this technology, is that he says that strikes are often taken when the sources of intelligence are only based on NSA electronic surveillance. So there isn't a human intelligence source confirming that the person on the receiving end of the drone strike is the person they're intending to target. What he basically told us is that this technology confirms that you're shooting at the cell phone or the SIM card that you want. You don't know who is holding that cell phone or SIM card. And he said in some cases you might know that you got the target, but he participated in operations where the target was known to have been killed, but not the people surrounding it. So our sources' concerns are really that there's been an over-reliance on this technology, and in the absence of human intelligence, the CIA and JSOC are launching missiles at people, sometimes without really knowing who they're firing them at. They're firing them at pieces of technology, which is obviously a concerning development and something that, you know, people who follow targeted killing operations in places like Pakistan and Yemen have sort of believed was going on for a long time, but we've never had the confirmation with the level of detail that the source and the Snowden documents provided us. Mm-hmm.
Well, now, so it seems like this is one of those things where kind of anybody could know better if they were interested in trying to know better because, you know, as everyone knows, human minds love to see patterns even where they're not really patterns. And we can come up with all kinds of explanations that seem to fit, that seem to make sense. And that's an okay way to find the truth sometimes if you're willing to change your mind and admit that maybe you're wrong or something. But people can convince themselves of all kinds of things. And it sounds like basically what we have here is sort of an automated conspiracy theory program where the computer spits out that, like, oh, yeah, you know, when you have a pattern of cell phones that talk to each other like these cell phones do, that usually means people that you should shoot missiles at. And then you have people who are deferring to the brilliance of the machine and its choosing, at least to a degree. And so mm-hmm. then the technology kind of makes it all clean. But nobody really, I think you talk about in the article here that after they kill people, then they go back at least some of the time. And the New York Times talked about this back a couple mm-hmm. of years ago. And they do a posthumous review to see if maybe you were innocent. Not that that's going to do you much good at that point.
It's incredibly backwards. And, you know, what was really interesting that our source told us was sort of familiar. If you've looked at some of these other whistleblower cases, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, when he tried to raise concerns about the problems that he identified in the program, he was just sort of shut down and was basically told that, you know, signals intelligence never lies, and that JSOC wouldn't be spending, you know, millions of dollars to kill these people if they didn't know exactly who they were going after. But in his experience, as he described it to us, you know, he regularly saw situations in which he had no idea who was on the receiving end of the strike, just that the technology that they had been tracking was there.
Does anyone know the percentage, or at least what the government claims the percentages are of so-called signature strikes, where, well, he's a fighting-age male with a rifle, seems like, and he has a cell phone, and so, yeah, he must be the guy we're looking for, compared to ones where at least they claim they really do know who they're shooting and that they have a reason to do so?
No, this would be a great thing to know. It would be a very helpful thing to know, and it would be a real step towards transparency if we had some sort of breakdown of the intelligence that fed into different strikes. But that just hasn't been the case with this administration when it comes to its targeted killing policies. A few months back, the White House, these two reports came out, these big human rights reports, one from Human Rights Watch on strikes in Yemen and another one on strikes in Pakistan by Amnesty International. Very detailed strikes. They came at the same time that the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Counterterrorism was given his preliminary findings in the investigation that he was doing on civilian casualties from drone strikes. All of these things 2 months ago, and this is sort of talked about in the piece that we wrote. This is how Brandon came to address the United Nations. There was this confluence of activities surrounding targeted killing. There was a report, there was the United Nations preliminary findings, and at the time, the White House was under a lot of pressure to respond to these reports and these allegations of civilian casualties that have been really mounting for years. And what the White House said was that they maintain a list, a number. They have a number of civilian casualties that have resulted from U.S. drone strikes abroad. And that number is significantly lower than anything that has been publicly reported.
All right, you got to hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with Ryan Devereaux from The Intercept. firstlook.org/The Intercept. The NSA's secret role in the U.S. assassination program is the new piece, the first one. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right. Goddamn commercial interrupted. I'm talking with Ryan Devereaux. He's a contributor to the first piece by Jeremy Scahill and Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept. Brand new venture. firstlook.org/The Intercept. And the headline is The NSA's Secret Role in the U.S. Assassination Program. And when the commercial interrupted, Ryan, you were explaining that the administration claims that the number of civilians killed in the drone wars is lower than tabulated by, I guess, the Bureau for Investigative Journalism or Human Rights Watch or even the New America Foundation. Is that correct?
Exactly. They say that the number is significantly lower than anything that's publicly available, but they won't disclose what that number is because that would create a risk to national security. What's fascinating, though, is that at the time that they were saying this, say last year, sort of the same time that it would look like we might strike Syria over the chemical weapons attack. And at that time, the administration was relying heavily on the same sort of human rights organizations that it was discrediting to build a case for intervention in Syria. But then when it comes to being asked about civilian casualties as a result of the drone program, suddenly those same organizations became less than credible.
Yeah.
So to your sort of point about, or your question as to whether or not we have any information that breaks down the different types of strikes that the United States is involved in abroad, the transparency on the part of this this administration has been sorely lacking.
Right. Well, and you know, I think part of this really is sort of, and you guys talk about this in the piece, right? Is this overconfidence in the mechanism here, basically. And then since there's no built-in review process, there's no real reason to look back most of the time unless they get in trouble over a real bad one, like hitting a wedding or something like that. One that real bad meaning one that gets a lot of publicity. But they have a lot of confidence in the brilliance of this thing. And I remember, I believe this is the very same sort of story of Gareth Porter's work in Truth Out that he won the Gellhorn Prize for, about the Delta Force raids and the Navy SEAL raids in Afghanistan at the height of the surge under McChrystal and under David Petraeus there, that they're using the same kind of data. And then there was even a whole lot of hype during the Iraq War, and Gareth Porter wrote about the Iraq, same kind of thing in Iraq, but there was a lot of hype about Bob Woodward saying, oh, their secret weapon was this network science about your father's brother's nephew's cousin's former roommate means there's a mark on your head. And where that's ridiculous to everybody else, to them, it's, wow, look at what we discovered, that if you just do the math right, you can blame all kinds of people for things. And that's the business they're in, and so they just go with it, even though to someone on the outside, it starts looking really wacky. Like, you guys are just caught up in you know, make-believe in a way. And in fact, the numbers, you know, that's what Gareth showed, is that the numbers of dead civilians in Afghanistan show that, you know, just like your local sheriff's department, they got the wrong house, you know?
Well, and what's fascinating, I always think is really interesting about this sort of issue, is that the president has acknowledged, in his big counterterrorism speech last May, the sort of temptation that is inherent in this kind of technology, especially for, for a president, that this seems like a very detached, a clean way to do things, and obviously preferable to a ground invasion. And of course, that's a sort of false dilemma, that we could only have drone strikes or ground invasions. But his administration seems to, at least in their public statements, acknowledge the temptation that exists with this technology, and yet they seem to have a really difficult time resisting it, or at least they have. I should note that, drone strikes did drop last year in Pakistan considerably, but they went up in Yemen. So this program, it continues to go, it continues to roll on, and it'll continue to roll on after this administration. And that's something that people should be deeply concerned about, because there are precedents being set, and precedents that have been set in the last several years with respect to these types of operations that could really open the door, as if they haven't already, for some absolutely egregious abuses of power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'll let you, if you would, please go into detail about shenanigans and Gilgamesh, but let's just say they seem to fit with this other news story that I saw today about this police chief from the Midwest somewhere, Dayton, Ohio, told the Washington Post, he's saying airplanes, but could be drones or blimps or whatever, but ultimately implementing the Gorgon Stare, which is what they have been trying to implement, and they have different names for it, whatever, but total surveillance awareness over Afghanistan, that they want to bring these technologies here, and they'll always be able to point to a missing child or some other horrible thing as the justification for it. But we keep developing these kind of technologies, and we keep bringing them home. And that could be really problematic, especially the way they talk about it here.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's a whole industry for developing this sort of technology. There's a whole sort of world that's built around this sort of stuff that is all about, creating, designing, selling, promoting this sort of technology. But the programs that you were referring to, Gilgamesh and Shenanigans, are these geolocation systems that the NSA uses. Gilgamesh is the NSA geolocation system. And then the CIA has a similar one that's called Shenanigans. And basically, the way that this works, technology that can be, that sort of acts as a fake cell phone data receiver. And it sort of stands in the middle, sort of man-in-the-middle attack, as they call it, that sweeps up all sorts of information from people's cell phones. And then this is the means by which a drone is able to hone in on a cell phone or a SIM card within a distance of 30 feet or so. So it's really, powerful technology. And of course, what our source said, what he told us, is that in its implementation, during their sort of training with Gilgamesh, a point is reinforced to them, and that is that this is not a science, but this is an art. And that sort of told him that this is quite far from perfect, right? This isn't the kind of thing, these programs aren't always going to get you the person that you want. You have to kind of work with them and work around them. And when we're talking about stuff that has weapon systems that have lethal potential, and we're talking about a standard that the administration has set that they are never going to take shots unless they're as certain as they can possibly be that civilians won't be harmed, then there are all sorts of concerns raised about something that's an art and not a science. Mm-hmm. Particularly if there's not going to be human intelligence involved in confirming, you know, that you are actually pointing a missile at the person that you want to point it at. One of the other things that I should mention that we found in our report, in our reporting, was that as of May 2013, President Obama had cleared 16 people in Yemen for targeting and 5 people in Somalia. And according to our source, before a mission is greenlit, that is, before a missile is fired, there must be 2 sources of intelligence. This is a really key point. I think both of those sources of intelligence can be electronic sources, so there doesn't have to be human intelligence. But once that 60 days runs out, if they don't take a strike, then commanders have to go back and basically resubmit their pitch for the target and, you know, resubmit their sort of evidence, right? Mm-hmm. And our source is concerned. What this sort of tells him is that it places a pressure on commanders, right, to take shots that might be risky because they could potentially feel that they might not get the shot again, right, and this thing result in, you know.
So it's supposed to be a fail-safe.
But you maybe also get the people around him, too.
Yeah, so it's supposed to be a fail-safe that these death warrants don't last forever. You only got 60 days, but what it ends up doing is it ends up encouraging the commanders to take shots that they might not necessarily take. Maybe they would wait for more information, better confirmation about who this person is or what they're up to. I was going to say, since this is all about their cell phones, why don't they just, and I know they have a lack of translators, but still, I mean, is nobody trying to tap these phones and maybe they could try to verify that way that, like, yeah, no, I really heard this guy plotting to defend himself against an American attack somewhere or whatever the accusation is, you know?
Yeah, our source indicated that the tracking isn't based on the content of calls, which is really interesting and surprising.
Yeah, I'm just saying, why not? I mean, if it's their cell phone that's caught your interest, go ahead and tap that thing. I mean, if we're assuming we're talking about, shooting talibs in Afghanistan or something like that, well, go ahead and make sure that you got the right guy as best you can, no? Or you don't want to mm-hmm. waste a missile.
True, missiles are expensive.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's the problem, is they do want to waste the missile, you know. Go ahead.
Yeah.
All right, yeah, these perverse incentives all over the place. That 60-day rush is one of those things where it sounds good at first, but did anyone think it through? And then you see what ends up being part of the consequences of that.
Yeah, it can really create a situation with a truly perverse incentive.
And then I'm sorry because we're damn near out of time. We got about half a minute, but I just want to point out that you guys talk about in the article here, Ryan, about how there are now more drone pilots being graduated than real fighter pilots, regular fighter pilots, and how this is, they compare it to the atom bomb. This is changing the entire history of warfare for the world. I just thought if they're pointing that out, it's worth pointing out that people should notice that this is a real revolution going on here, right?
Well, I mean, it is fascinating. I tend to sometimes worry that there's a little bit too much emphasis on technology. Drones, after all, are a system, they're a platform, they're a weapon system. And what's really most important is the policies and the ways in which they're employed. Granted, yeah, this stuff has changed the game, but what really matters is the way that policies are implemented and whether there's transparency and accountability.
Right. All right, everybody, that is Ryan Devereaux. He's at The Intercept, firstlook.org, part of the brand new project and part of the brand new article with Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill. He's a contributor to it. The NSA's secret role in the U.S. assassination program. Congratulations on y'all's first piece. Talk to you soon. Thanks again.
Thanks a lot.